This is Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Fred Marshall. Today is April 25th, 2003. It's about 9.04 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Marshall, you're in San Jose, California. Let's continue, sir. We have been talking about the Tet Offensive and the aftermath of the Tet Offensive, and you mentioned that you wanted to add something about that.
Yeah, there's something I recalled right after we hung up that I had read. I don't know when I read it or where I read it, but apparently there was a historical point of view developed after, much later, in the Tet Offensive, that there had arisen quite a bit of friction between the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. The Viet Cong, of course, were indigenous South Vietnamese. And this theory, and again, I don't know who to ascribe it to, but it made sense. It said that the North Vietnamese needed to find a way to eliminate as many Viet Cong as they could, because in post-war Vietnam, assuming they would win the war, they wanted to have total power. They didn't want to have to share power with the Southerners. And this particular theory said that the North Vietnamese planned the Tet Offensive so that the Viet Cong, many Viet Cong units, would be literally wiped out. They would send them up against units and positions that would pretty much ensure their destruction, and basically eliminate the Viet Cong as a post-war threat to the North Vietnamese themselves, a post-war political and military threat. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much credence to put in that, but it would explain, as I recall, the tremendously high number of Viet Cong casualties as opposed to North Vietnamese, which were substantial too. And after Tet, as I remember and as I have read, the Viet Cong basically ceased to be any kind of threat whatsoever. So I don't know if that's true or not, but it, in context of hindsight, it makes sense. So.
Well, that's absolutely one of the theories. What was your personal experience? You had some direct contact with the enemy.
Again, as I remember, and this is a long time ago, this is the first time I've really talked this much about the war in 35 years, so... as I do recall, almost all of our prisoners after Tet were North Vietnamese. We had very few Viet Cong. We had a few brought in, but again, a lot of those were picked up by National Police and the Rough Puffs. So but that's just what limited memory I do have, that there was very little activity of Viet Cong after Tet.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the Tet Offensive in general? Do you think it was a smart move for the enemy,
well,
either directed by the NVA or VC? More on their own to actually do this?
As a PR move, it was pretty brilliant, because quite a few times during the course of the war, at least when I was there, we made these rosy predictions, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, all this kind of stuff, that we were making tremendous progress, and we weren't, for other reasons. As a PR move, it was great, because I think at home, domestically, we've been kind of lulled into a false sense of security. We had been achieving quite a large degree of success in the battlefield, especially up in I Corps. Against the North Vietnamese, and government PR kind of let on that we had pretty much pacified lots of the country, and the Tet Offensive showed that at least that the enemy could operate in amount of coordinated attack nationwide. I just think psychologically it was a pretty good coup by the North Vietnamese. Of course, it was militarily where they got wiped out everywhere. Mm-hmm. And what wasn't publicized was, you know, this was the Tet Truce. And a lot of the South Vietnamese troops were home on leave, enjoying the holiday with their families. Mm-hmm. And most of the units, as I recall, and as I've read, were undermanned. And I don't recall in our area, in Three Corps, that there were any South Vietnamese units that were overrun. There was a horrific battle up at a little town called An Lock, about 50 miles north of us. But North Vietnamese 9th Division attacked the town, and... the Vietnamese unit that was there, the Arvin unit that was there, was severely depleted because of the holiday, and they just fought ferociously for several days until they could to get relieved. And this kind of stuff never made it into the papers. The photographs of the Viet Cong or the, you know, on the U.S. embassy grounds and that kind of thing, that got the headline. But militarily, it was a horrific defeat, but of course our media, our skeptical media at home turned it into a victory for them. And politically, I guess it was, because it showed that they still had a lot of strength left.
Right, right. What about the progress in the war for the United States? Did you see that this was happening in 68 or not?
No, we didn't. We didn't have the big picture at all. You know, we didn't even get much information what was going on in the rest of the country. We were just concerned with that little area of Three Corps there. And the larger picture was somewhat obscured to us. recall that all of us, at least in my little unit, were frustrated at the incremental aspect of the war, even at this late date, that Johnson was still clinging to this policy of incrementalism, gradualism. And I think that reflected, he wanted the North, I know, to realize that these Americans would just keep applying the pressure till we quit.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, that can be looked at, and it was looked at by the North Vietnamese as a sign of weakness. You know, if the Americans already wanted to win this thing, they'd come in here and win it,
mm-hmm.
instead of just gradually turning up the pressure and allowing us to gradually meet that pressure. You know, it was a doomed strategy.
Tell me what you think about civilian control of the military.
Well, under our form of government, of course, is absolutely essential. But like we just saw in the recent conflict and the continuing conflict in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
if you let the military do its thing without having to be second-guessed by congressional committees, things go a lot quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have Johnson picking the targets in North Vietnam, you know, mainly out of political considerations, let's bomb them here, let's hit them here, you know. I wasn't aware that Johnson had any tremendous military background, at least in tactics and strategy. And I know a lot of commanders were concerned, gee, if I do this and if it doesn't work out, then some congressional committee is going to get on my case. And I just thought it was, you know, my little point of view, it was just kind of, again, incrementalism is,
mm-hmm.
was a stupid way to fight a war. I remember back during the Civil War, General Jubal Early, who was not a very nice person himself, said, you want to win it, get there firstest with the mostest.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there second with just enough to hold on, apparently. People forget, you know, they read their history in the articles and say, hey, we got 600,000 men over there. You know, 80% of those aren't in combat. You know, they're support and supply and doing stuff like me. And our combat forces, while substantial, were proportionally not that large when you compare it to everybody else that was over there that was not involved in combat, was involved in combat support. So
mm-hmm.
that just didn't work.
Did you keep up with the news from home very much? How difficult was that for you?
I didn't keep up with too much news from home. The only newspaper we got was the Stars and Stripes. My wife would occasionally send me newspaper clippings out of the local paper here, the San Jose Mercury and the San Francisco Chronicle, which is a great paper to wrap fish in, still is. And it was mostly irritating stuff. You know, as time went on, and the liberals and the leftists who had supported our buildup, when Kennedy was president,
mm-hmm.
up until 63, now were totally against the effort. And interesting thing, we noticed that most of the anti-war press on war protest on college campuses stopped as soon as the draft was ended in the early 70s. That was not remarked upon at the time, I don't believe. But
mm-hmm.
I didn't get too much news from home except just a few newspaper clippings about
mm-hmm.
my wife would send me.
Were you able to make any Mars calls home to your wife, or was it just letters?
No, just letters. And that was the good thing, of course. We got to write free. We had free franking
right.
privileges. And so I wrote almost every day, and it was just, hi, I'm still alive, I love you, and that was it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But I still have all my letters, and there's some the ones she sent to me. I think that the fun part of that, not fun, but touching part of it in letters, it was getting letters from total strangers, because like in our conflicts today, there are many organizations that just send letters anonymously to some soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And I got quite a few from people around the Bay Area and all around the country, too, that were just randomly sent to my unit, and the mail clerk would say, oh, let's give this one to you, okay. And I thought that was kind of nice, just total strangers writing a letter to saying, you know, you might not want to be where you are, and it's probably pretty awful, but, you know, we support you. And I thought that was a very, very, very powerful
mm-hmm.
message.
How often did that happen?
Oh, maybe once a month, not very, very frequently at all.
Okay. In general, looking at your units and everything, what did you guys do for entertainment and recreation?
Entertainment, recreation. Not familiar with the terms in that context. we didn't have anything at all. We had a little bar
mm-hmm.
you know, on our post. But we had a feel that we... Somehow, we had two softball games that I recall during the dry season. Of course, during the rainy season, you couldn't even get to first base. Played cards, Mm-hmm. That's about it. Talked, you know, and there was really nothing to do of a fun nature, at least on post or in the nearby towns. And, all of us stayed out of the town, the little village, the hamlet of Fukung, provincial capital of Fukung. Down the road, we didn't go there except to buy food occasionally. In the little hamlet of Fuloy, which was outside our gates, there were a bunch of bars and places over there that some of the main line troops, the bigger units, went to. But we mainly stayed on our little post. We really had nothing much to do.
Why did you stay on the post? Were you advised not to go into the town?
Well, no, but we didn't have a 9-to-5 job,
right?
You know, and sometimes we'd work all night depending on enemy activity, and it was just difficult to schedule that. And most of us didn't have, most of my guys, we weren't drinkers, we weren't smokers, we didn't have any affinity for the barfly type of lifestyle. So we just didn't patronize it.
Mm-hmm. Was alcohol any kind of a problem, or did you see a lot of abuse of that?
Not on our little post. No, we had an officer's club, which was just kind of a little hut with a bar in it, and an NCO club. But I don't recall ever seeing anybody drunk. People drank a lot, mainly beer. But I don't ever recall seeing anybody drunk or talking to anybody that was drunk or having anybody in our unit, our office, come to work drunk.
Okay.
Because you had to stand guard duty every other night. And if you were sleeping on guard duty because you were drunk, I mean, you were in serious trouble.
Right.
Because our commanding officer of a little post, the colonel, can't remember his name, he made no bones about that. You show up drunk for duty, and your ass is in a sling.
Mm-hmm.
So he meant it. You know, and again, in our unit, most of us had some college, and some were college graduates. And I think we were smart enough to realize that, and I didn't drink then, still don't. But most of us were smart enough to realize that even though it's relatively quiet here, you know, you never know what's going to happen, and we don't need to have it. We need to have a clear head.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't recall any of that problem at all.
I assume then if there was no drug use,
you never had any inkling of that whatsoever. Only time I found out about that is when we got back to the States.
Hmm. Okay. Let me ask you about your spiritual beliefs. Did they change at all because of your experience there that 1 year?
No. Intensified it up to a point, probably. I was Christian, still am, Baptist. And at first I had a few doubts, as everybody does when you're put into a totally different situation than you're used to. You know, where has God gone, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember we had a memorial service for one of our field advisors who was killed, because the division had three regiments in our part of Three Corps, and each of the regiments had several battalions, three or four battalions. During the 4 years up to the date, the month that I left, we had 144 men that had served in Advisory Team 70, both where I was and out in the field. And the field advisors, of course, they had the dangerous jobs. Now, the regimental training officers and the people that worked directly with the Arvin infantry units. And of the 144 men that had served in Advisory Team 70 up through October 68, the month I left, 45 had been killed.
Hmm.
And that was about a 25% fatality rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that we had a memorial service for one of the guys who I knew, but whose name, sadly, I have forgotten. The chaplain mentioned, and I still remember this, I don't know why, the chaplain mentioned in his comments that God is not the author of death. You know, and he went on to explain what he meant by that. And just in case any of us were backsliding in our faith because we had developed the attitude of, you know, why am I here? Where is God gone? Why is this happening? But he was a pretty sharp guy, and he put the thing in a large historical and scriptural context. I never forgot that.
Hmm.
No matter how awful things are here or anywhere else, that it's not God's fault. God didn't do it. And God didn't create the conditions for it. He didn't make the decisions that led to this. So do your duty.
Did you believe that then?
Don't worry about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Did it help you then?
Like this, not like this. This wasn't the first war in human history, so, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it gave me a little bit of. It gave me a little bit of moral strength at that particular time.
How much access did you have to the chaplains?
Very rarely. We had a chaplain that came by very infrequently. Like I said, the mainline units, they had their own chaplains, of course, in mm-hmm. chapels. We had none. Mm-hmm. And occasionally, a Catholic priest would come by on a semi-regular basis to offer Mass to the Catholics. But the only time we ever saw a chaplain or a priest, basically, was when we were playing taps for somebody.
Hmm. Okay. Going back to the recreation entertainment question, did you guys listen to a lot of music?
Not really. We had the Armed Forces radio station over there came in pretty good where we were, because we were about 40, 50 miles from Saigon. But I don't recall listening to too much music. A lot of us had tape decks, because mm-hmm. Reel-to-reel, these little reel-to-reel things you could mm-hmm. buy back then. And my wife sent me several tapes of music from home, and I would play on my tape recorder. We mostly listened to that. Mm-hmm. Very little. We had no theater or anything like that. We had movies occasionally shown on a sheet in our mess hall.
Mm-hmm. But, do you remember any of the movies you saw?
No. I don't recall seeing that many.
Okay.
Most of them were not very good. Abbott and Costello and Three Stooges and garbage like that.
Mm-hmm. What about songs? Do you hear any songs today that take you back to that time?
Yeah, I think I mentioned in my question there, Homeward Bound mm-hmm. By Simon and Garfunkel, which was not about the war at all. It's just, the line, I wish I was homeward bound.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a song, it was an instrumental record back then by Paul Marriott, a French orchestra, called Love is Blue, which was kind of popular at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife still cries when she hears it. That was
because she listened to it when you
were
there.
Yeah, that was one of her favorite songs while she was backstage waiting for me, and it just kind of made her sad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get to attend any USO shows?
No, it was. I think, like I said in my questionnaire, the nobody paid any attention to the advisory teams. We were just a little footnote. It's like, oh yeah, the advisory teams. We want to do something for them, but. We had a couple of little USO shows that would come through, just some candy striper type things, some cute young girls and a mm-hmm. couple of singers. But they may come into the mess hall and sing a song and shake hands and give us a candy bar or something and then leave.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Hope dropped by about 50, 70 miles away one year. Most of the officers got to go see Bob Hope, but the enlisted men, of course, those ones that actually did the work,
mm-hmm.
we didn't. Fess Parker showed up one mm-hmm. day, Davy Crockett,
and
Arthur O'Connell, whom I recognized. He walked into the mess hall one day, great character actor,
mm-hmm.
a lot of great roles in some good film. And he walked into the mess hall one day with his aide, and I just looked, Arthur O'Connell, and he walked over and said hi. It struck me because he sat down and talked to me for a while. There was almost nobody in the mess hall, just me and a couple guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to me for about 15 minutes, and he said, when I get back home, I'm going to call your wife. And gave him my phone number, and I gave him her phone number, and he did. He went back home and called her.
Really?
It was an excited letter from her week or so later, This guy called me, and he had seen you and spoken to you, and mm-hmm. He was. So that was really a good morale booster for her and mm-hmm. for me too. Bess Parker, I still remember how huge this guy was, just monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt if anybody nowadays would know who they were, That's all we had.
What did those visits by celebrities mean to you, and do you think what did it mean overall to the military forces?
Oh, I thought that it was a tremendous morale booster. That somebody that didn't have to be there
mm-hmm.
would put themselves in danger, because anywhere you were in Vietnam, you were in danger somehow. You never knew when, but these people put themselves in danger just to come say hi to us and to come to our little outpost instead of going to the 101st Airborne or the Screaming Eagles or some 82nd Airborne or one of the Marine divisions. Would come to see us, and that was really important.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were, like I said, the advisory effort was and is basically an ignored aspect of the war.
Why do you think that's so?
Well, nobody knew we were there. I mean, we were pretty much anonymous. I mean, rightfully so, the big mainline combat units, rightfully and justifiably, got most of the attention. But if you peel back the curtains and look deeper into the war effort, you would see all the advisory teams spread around the country doing important work. And I've recently, since I got involved with this interview stuff, I've looked in several big bookstores for the first time, mm-hmm. Near home, Barnes & Noble and Borders, places like that, looking in the Vietnam War section, and in almost none of the books can you find any mention of MACV and the advisory mm-hmm. teams. Not in the index, not anywhere. It's like the teams never existed. So even today, it'd be difficult to find out about that. There are a couple websites, one of which has gone off the air, that listed all the advisory teams and where they were and what they did. But other than that, I've seen very little mention of the advisory effort, which went on for quite a long time mm-hmm. under a couple different names.
Mm-hmm. It was the earliest experience the Americans had in
Yeah,
South
well, it was
Asia.
A totally unique experience. So nothing else, nothing like this had ever happened in World War II, we had men in the Philippines and things like that. But that was mainly to help form an insurrection and gather intelligence. Mm-hmm. It's quite a different activity. So I still to this day have no idea how many men were involved in the advisory effort and all the different teams around the country. I don't even know how many teams there were. I think 100.
There were thousands of men involved in the advisory effort over the years. Tell me about the relationship you formed with your fellow advisors there for that 1 year.
Oh, boy. That was pretty powerful. Sergeant Mai Khao Vo and Sergeant Tran Van Nguyen were the two Vietnamese sergeants that I worked with. Sergeant Vo most of the time. Sergeant Nguyen came in later on in my tour. And I would see Sergeant Vo almost every day. And he had never worked with an American that spoke any Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And he spoke much better English than I did Vietnamese, although both of our skills improved over time. He was just shocked that he got to work with an American that spoke his language fairly well. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a heck of a lot of time together at the IPW Center and up at the G2 office and out on helicopter trips and riding around in trucks and jeeps and whatnot and fiddling around the little hamlets and villages talking to people. Great guy. He had a wife and daughter who lived back in Saigon. And he rode this little Honda 50 putt-putt motorbike, mm-hmm. which he was very proud of. And just a great guy, kind of a short, stocky little guy. Great sense of humor, optimistic, friendly, man with complete integrity, as opposed to some of his officers. Just a great guy. We got to be pretty good friends. It was really hard to leave him. In fact, I probably missed him when I left. I probably missed him more than any of the Americans that I worked with. I spent the most time with him, basically, at least during the day. Mm-hmm. And we wrote for months and months and months after the war ended. And the advisory team moved up the road to another location a few months after I left, and he told me what a hole that was compared to where they had been. And I guess in, I don't know, 70, early 70, late 60 and early 70, the letter stopped, and I never heard from him again. Don't know if he got killed or captured or just said, why continue doing this, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall writing to Sergeant Nguyen at all, because he was kind of a standoffish guy. Friendly, but he wasn't as sociable and as Sergeant Vo was. So, but Sergeant Vo's a great guy. I got a lot of pictures of him still. Mm-hmm. I have lots of slides. I got about 800 slides of the camp and all my activities there.
Wow. Did you ever take any R&Rs?
Well, let's see. How am I going to say this? I was scheduled to go to Bangkok.
Okay.
But I forget. Something happened. I can't even remember what happened. Something happened. I think it was Tet Offensive or something happened in the area that I couldn't go. I don't even remember the reasons I couldn't go. My idiot lieutenant went, but I didn't. That was good because the guy, like I said, was an idiot. ROTC idiot. And we have a little in-country R&R facility at Vung Tau, mm-hmm. old French resort city on the coast. And I went there twice. For 1 day, and it was okay. They had a nice little hostel there for American soldiers, and a nice buffet with real food. And they actually had real milk instead of this filled milk, which we had. This instead of milk fat in the milk, they put coconut oil in it, mm-hmm. and so it'd keep better, I guess. I remember having real milk, and we were just really shocked by that. And they had a beach there that we could ride a bus out to and relax in the sun and play on the beach, South China Sea,
mm-hmm.
and not much to do, shuffleboard, cards, and this kind of thing. And it was a pretty safe place. And very, very beautiful, a lot of old French villas there in Bougainville, a very, very nice area. I went there twice. The first time I went, my wallet was stolen out of my room, I think by the maid. And the second time I went, I had a drunk American soldier break into my room about 2 o'clock in the morning during a thunderstorm, and thought it was his room, and it wasn't even his hotel. So I had to drag him downstairs and call the MPs. And it was just a nice little break. But those are my 2 days off in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Two official days off.
Mm-hmm. Were you resentful in the fact that you never really got to get out of the country?
Not really. A lot of guys, they went to Bangkok and Tokyo. And in fact, none of the enlisted personnel in my unit, as I recall, left the country for R&R. We didn't begrudge anybody else going on R&R, especially the guys in the combat units,
mm-hmm.
who rarely got any breaks either. But I don't recall any of us going anywhere, because
okay.
if they had, they would have come back and talked about it. I remember that. But we didn't really begrudge it. It slowed down the pace of my tour there. It was better just to keep busy, keep going, keep focused, and let the time pass quickly instead of kind of stop it and let's take a break from the war now. I'm going to the beach for a day or two and
mm-hmm.
lay on the sand and then come back and pick up where we left off. I just kind of preferred to keep things moving.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there a particular humorous incident that you recall from that year, something that stands out in your mind?
Yeah, I think as I said in my in question 75, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Bacon, good buddy of mine back there, he had this. Rich Little was a real big deal back in the States at the time. I don't know how old you are, how much of this you remember, but
I know Rich Little.
Rich Little
mm-hmm.
was an impersonator, and he was really good at,
mm-hmm.
in the 60s and 70s. And Bacon was a good impersonator too. And we had these two sergeants in our unit, Sergeant Anderson, who died last year, and Staff Sergeant Bob Scannell, and they each had unique personalities and voices and mannerisms that would really set them apart from the crowd. And Bacon just loved to impersonate these guys. And
mm-hmm.
whenever we would get kind of tired or down or ticked off about something, Bacon would break into one of his impersonations, Sergeant Anderson or Sergeant Scannell.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, don't recall a lot of humor.
Okay. How about a particular brave action that you witnessed? Does something stand out in your mind with that?
Only that I heard of from what other members of our team had done out with the battalions and the regiments,
mm-hmm.
Their bravery under fire, this kind of thing. We had our local headquarters unit had what we called a Recondo platoon, which was led by an American first lieutenant named Callard, I think it was. And they got in several good firefights in the area with Viet Cong units and occasionally North Vietnamese, because these are the guys who would lay out in the woods at night and listen and kind of sneak up and try to find enemy base camps and stuff like that. And they had several rather bloody fights,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. But other than that, we were kind of divorced from any kind of situation that would provoke bravery.
Right. Tell me about your impression of and your experience with the Vietnamese civilians.
Now, they were resilient people. They had some kind of war had been going on for a long time in their lives. They were creative. They were resourceful. They were trying to be optimistic and make the best of a bad situation. I spent quite a bit of time on the road, not quite a bit of time, at least 1 or 2 days a week, where I spent at least part of the day out in a hamlet or at the National Police Station or in a village or something, looking at sabotage damage or talking to villagers about any information they might want to give to us. I had to be careful about that because you never know who you're talking to. And if you talk to somebody and they're willing to tell you what they've seen or heard, the guy standing next to them might be Viet Cong. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That person is trying to be helpful and do something positive for his society in the war effort, might end up being shot in the head. So you had to be really careful about that. But I enjoyed the people. I never had any act of incivility or lack of kindness for any of them. We had Vietnamese women that would come in and do our clothes. They just wash our clothes in buckets and hang them outside on bushes and lines to dry, and they were all very pleasant. The people that we go into town, we go into Fukuong sometimes to buy these long French baguette breadsticks and things like that, and fresh fruit if we could find it. We felt totally safe among them. They were very pleasant. I remember one time I was driving back from Bienhoa alone in a Jeep, and the radiator overheated. And I was in this little one-lane road. I knew where I was, but I was in this little one-lane road, and I'd all by myself there in the woods, and here comes this Vietnamese farmer walking down the road with his black pajamas and his conical hat, and he asked me what was. I remember the conversation was in Vietnamese. You know, I said, "Am I overheated here?" And I need a thak nuk, something to carry water in. And he went over to another little hut, a little house, and it was his. And came up with a big tin can, big can. There was a creek right there, so I went down the creek and got some water and refilled the radiator. And thanked him very much, and didn't have anything to give him. Usually, you give him cigarettes, something like that. But we just told him I was very appreciative. Drove off. Even a situation like that, you know, total stranger willing to stop and help out. And I was just always pretty impressed by these people. They had to put up with so much because you know, the Viet Cong would harass them at night and kidnap them, all the while claiming to be their liberator, and destroy their villages and kidnap them to carry ammunition and weapons and whatnot. And they lived under horrible conditions because we'll never know how many of them got killed in the war, which we try to avoid, of course, but it's a sad fact of where people die. But I have nothing but good positive memories of the Vietnamese, especially the kids. I remember that Vung Tao. There was always little kids fishing along. We had a couple of little rock walls along the coast, on the beach there, where the beach was kind of rocky. And there was always little kids fishing down there, and they were always willing to come running up. They always want chewing gum, of course, come running up, and chiclets, and this kind of stuff. They were always very polite and fun, and I never had any apprehensions around any of them at any time. I just felt sorry for them, because, like I said in my my questionnaire, as time went on, it became apparent to me, at least in my own mind, that we were going to botch the whole thing through a lack of will and abandon these people. That was a sad thing, because after I got home, when the communists did take over, you know, our media again didn't make a big deal of all the tens of thousands of people that had to be re-educated, were put in prison camps. I never know how many of those people I met. You know, where did they end up? Did they end up in a prison camp or worse? But overall, you know, I was always enjoyed being with them.
Okay. What about Vietnam, the country itself?
Well, I didn't see that much of it. I saw Saigon, which was a madhouse. The country is beautiful. I remember when I flew from Tan Son Nhut Air Base in Saigon on a Huey helicopter up to Lam Sa, up to the 5th Division. It's the first time I've been in the air during the daytime, because we came in at night to Bienhoa on our airliner. But so the first time I got to receive the country was when I got up the helicopter flying up to my advisory team, and it was just beautiful, just lush and green, and it looked like Kentucky for all I could tell. And you could look up to the north and see Nui Ba Den, Black Widow Mountain. And the country itself is beautiful and would have a lot of tourist potential if it weren't governed by idiots, and collectivist idiots at that. A lot of rivers and streams. The weather was fun. Kind of like East Texas, actually. Hot and dry during part of the year and hot and rainy during the rest of the year. So, it was a pretty country, and it was, you know, primitive, of course. But I'd been to Mississippi before, so I knew what primitive was. So, It was okay. The only aspect of it that was difficult for me was I spent the previous year in El Paso, Texas, at language school, and kind of a 180 degree turn between El Paso and Vietnam. So getting used to the climate was difficult. But the country was beautiful and had a lot of potential in terms of resources and tourism and whatnot. It was deceptively peaceful. I think I said in my questionnaire here. Because what it looked like during the day isn't what it sounded like at night. At night was when all the fun stuff happened, at least in our area.
Is there anything else you want to talk about before we leave Vietnam, about your in-country experience?
not that I can think of, and then you covered it pretty well here in your questions.
Okay. Let me take a break and change out this disc.
Okay.
So tell me how you left Vietnam in October 68.
Well, that was another the oddities about this war, you know, in Korea and World War II, the big wars. Your unit went over as a unit, and you stayed there until the job was done. Like we had many men in World War II were gone for 4 or 5 years. In Vietnam, it was more like a business effort. You knew exactly the day you would leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. It's disconcerting. The closer you get to your DROS date, your date estimated to return from overseas, the edgier you get, because you hear all these stories about guys getting killed in their last day or their next to last day and whatnot. So as your time winds down, you do tend to get a little bit edgy. But it was just kind of an oddball thing. You get up one morning. I got up on October, 13th or 14th or 18th, I don't remember the day anymore. Got up, and the day before I had said goodbye to everybody, and this was a kind of, we had guys going home, you know, probably about once a week somebody would leave, once every 2 weeks, and there was no party or anything. It was just you'd shake hands all around and hug your buddies, and you know, and exchange addresses and whatnot, and hope to get together again. And then the hard part was saying goodbye to Sergeant Nguyen and Sergeant Vall. That was rough, but we got through that okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you put on your dress khakis, and you get your bag, and you give away all the stuff you don't want to take home, and you walk down to the helicopter pad, and it's like waiting for a bus, you know? And you just like, it's like leaving work in the afternoon and going home.
Mm-hmm.
You just pack up, and at least for me, on big units, it was different, but on an advisory team, you just get up in the morning, you get dressed, you go see the company clerk, you sign out, you have a checklist to go through, you have to go have your commanding officer check you off on various things, to turn in your weapons, and, you know, just, and then you sign out. And you walk down to the helicopter pad, and you sit down there on a wooden bench, and finally your bus shows up with big rotors on it, and you hop on the Huey, and you fly off to Tan Son Nhut, and you get there, and you get on a bus, and you drive down to the out-processing station, and you do some more paperwork, and then you, depending on when your plane leaves, you're given, you already have your orders to go home. You just don't know what flight you're going to be on, and you go down there, you just sit around and wait, and then you take a bus back at the Tan Son Nhut Air Base and wait till your flight is called, and you get on the flight and you go home. And you go home, and I got back to Oakland, back to Travis Air Force Base from where I had left. And it was a strange thing. I still recall it was the quietest flight. You know, I still remember it was a Flying Tiger Airlines Convair 880.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I remember that. But it was, and I just remember on the plane how quiet it was.
How about when you took off from Tan Son Nhut?
There was a little bit of cheering and clapping and whistling. But the people on the plane were from all different units. Some were going on leave, and some were going on R&R, and you know, some were going home. Most were going home.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when we took off, there was some clapping and cheering and things like that. But then it just quieted down. People were just so relieved. You know, is it really over? Is this how it ends? You know, not with a bang, with a whimper. You just get on a plane and you leave,
mm-hmm.
and you leave all that behind. And it was just an odd sensation that it would end on such a note. But I got back to Travis Air Force Base. And I got on a bus, went to the Oakland Army Replacement Station, Oakland Army Station, and signed out there, had a physical, drew some blood, and spent the night. And our reward was a steak dinner. You know, everybody that came back got a steak dinner. Hadn't had a steak in a year. Not a great piece of meat, but better than what we had had.
Mm-hmm.
And you sign out, you settle up on any pay you might have coming or any pay you might owe, and they gave you a whole, I said, the guy says, where are you going, Marshal? I said, I'm going about 50 miles south of here to San Jose, you know. They give you a whole new uniform. I said, what do I need a whole new uniform for? I'm out of the Army. I'm going home. They give you a whole set of dress greens. They give you a new Army. They give you a new field jacket.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. Something to wear home, you know. So I put it on and wore it home. Next day, my wife drove up in our shiny new 1967 Toyota Corona, light blue.
Mm-hmm.
Picked me up and drove me home. You know, I hadn't seen her. I saw it at the airport the night before. Excuse me. She was there, and my parents were there, and her parents were there,
mm-hmm.
and she didn't recognize me.
Really,
it's really strange. We got off the plane and went across the tarmac, And I was with two guys that I was in language school with, whom she had met before we shipped out to Vietnam, because we had gone to dinner at Senor Pico's in San Francisco with these two friends, Lenny Hinkle from Ohio and James Cogsall from Narragansett, Rhode Island. And they had gone on to other advisory teams. But we ended up on the same flight coming home. That was a great thing, because I saw Lenny and Cogs were there, and we didn't sit together on the plane, but we had a stop in Honolulu on the way back. And I called my wife from Honolulu. I forgot about that. I called her. First time she'd heard my voice in a year. And I got to talk to Lenny and Cogs for a while, too. When we got off the plane together, and she had met them once, a year earlier.
Mm-hmm.
She'd known me for years. We were married, and we came walking across the tarmac together. And I still remember this, and I still tease her about it, too. She said, "Lenny, Cogs, hi, where's Fred?" I was right there with him. But I had lost a lot of weight. I was pretty gaunt. And she just didn't recognize me at all. And I just kind of waved my hand and said, "Hi, honey, I'm home," or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And we had a big hug, of course. But we didn't have much time together there. We had to get on the bus and went to Oakland. And the next day, she came back and picked me up. And it was just like a wife picking up her husband after work at the train station or something. And she had rented an apartment in Santa Clara, near Santa Clara University, $105 a month. Got some furniture together. So one day I'm in the jungle, and the next day I'm home. I spent the night. And my mother-in-law worked at a very classy, high-level department store nearby, I. Magnin's. They're out of business now, but very ritzy place, like Saks Fifth Avenue. And she had talked to their store manager about a job for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager said, "Well, have you come on in and we'll see what he can do." And I went in the next day, 48 hours after I left Vietnam, and here I am in a fancy department store interviewing for a job in the shipping department.
How disconcerting was that for you?
Well, I was just so overjoyed to be home at that point that the culture shock part of it really hadn't set in yet.
Mm-hmm.
But over the next couple of days, as things slowed down a little bit, and I had a chance to realize I'm home. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't get killed. I didn't get hurt. And here I am in this fancy department store where, you know, a blouse costs $90.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember people were very, very nice to me at first. You know, you're back in Vietnam. Huh? Great. Glad you made it home, this kind of thing. But most people didn't seem to want to be near me or talk to me for a while, and I guess they were just trying to figure out if I was normal.
Mm-hmm.
The media stereotypes at the time about Vietnam veterans were pretty perverse. But I settled into that job and worked there. I tried to get back into college, but I missed the deadline by a month.
Mm-hmm.
And the store manager was a friend of the ex-mayor of San Jose, Al Rufo, who just died 3 months ago, who was on the State College Board of Trustees. And she appealed to him personally. This guy just came back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He missed the college. He didn't know he was going to get out of the Army this early. And he missed the application deadline to get back into San Jose State. Can you help him? And he tried, but couldn't. So it took a while to get back into college. So I worked in the basement of a department store for the next 9 months or so,
mm-hmm.
until I got back into school, next 10 months, I guess. But like I said in my questionnaire here, that I had a hard time sleeping for a while, especially when helicopters would fly over and whatnot. But I adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such an abrupt end to my service. You know, it's just like, okay, you spent a year in Vietnam, and thanks a lot, and I go home and get on with your life.
Right.
And it's just this abrupt, sharp cutoff there, and your buddies are still 8,000 miles away. But every morning I get up and read the paper just of every bit of news that I could find about Vietnam, because
mm-hmm.
finding out anything about my unit, of course, is impossible, but I did look for anything happening in my particular area.
So you kept up with the war once you got home?
Yeah, I did, because it was always interesting. I'd never seen American TV news about the war,
mm-hmm.
and at least since I left, of course. And I was wondering sometimes, are these guys reporting on the same conflict that I was in? And I don't want to get into that. Take the rest of the day.
Okay.
But it was a shocking way to end things up. Happy, but
right.
Still to this day, I look back on that. I have a picture of myself that somebody took as I'm sitting on the bus going up to Tunsa, knew it, and I'm happy and smiling and clean-shaven, you know, and the day before I was filthy and grubby and dirty and sweaty, and and here I am making a fancy department store 48 hours later.
Do you think that was a mistake?
I was hoping somebody would ask, you know.
Right.
What were you doing 48 hours ago? Hey, let me tell you.
That was a war.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a mistake the U.S. government made?
Well, it gave people hope, you know, that you're not going to go away for the duration. You're going to go away, and there is a limit to this. There is life after Vietnam, and here is your date we're going to give you, and you, if you're still alive, you will go home on this date. So it was a good morale builder in that sense. It probably made some guys, especially the guys in the combat units, just almost paranoid the last few days of their tour, you know, because you never, because in the combat units, if it was your turn to, if it was your day to go home, they just take a helicopter out and go back to your division headquarters and process out and leave. If you came over by yourself, if you came over as a replacement, you might just leave your unit and go home by yourself. If you came over with your unit, of course, you'd all go home together. You know, good sense of camaraderie there. But I don't know. It kind of put the war on a business-like basis, basically. I guess it had its good points in terms of morale and finality to the whole thing. It would give you something to look forward to. But on the other hand, it may have communicated to the enemy, who was pretty smart people, that this is just another aspect of American war process that isn't very smart. It just kind of tells us that they don't have the will to win. I guess it could be interpreted in that way. Maybe it was.
Tell me about your impressions of the anti-war movement once you got home.
Oh, boy. What did I say in my thing here? Contempt. It says the most ignorant, narrow-minded, intolerant, morally bankrupt, solipsistic people in human history, and they're still with us. They're still out there and protesting the war in Iraq. The same people with the same narrow-minded point of view that don't seem to have any difficulty supporting butchering dictators and collectivist, totalitarian, military regimes, but worry about our efforts to do something about it. Back at San Jose State, like I said in my questionnaire, almost all of my professors were anti-war. They didn't know why. The few that found out that I was a Vietnam veteran, I had one, Dr. Fink. He was my American seminar and American literature professor. I had him twice. And he could not conceal his contempt for the war effort, for soldiers, and he could not conceal his basic support for the aims of the communists. And I aroused his ire on more than one occasion.
Did he know you were a vet? And
yes, he did, in a very embarrassing way, because I still remember most of my professors, I don't care what the course was, they would make the course somehow relevant to Vietnam, and this was quite a stretch on many of their parts, but if you're a deconstructionist, I guess you can do anything you want. But I still remember one, he was making a comment about the war, about something, and I still remember at the time we were reading She Stoops to Conquer by Edith Wharton, which is about the upper classes of Boston. Doesn't have anything to do with the war, but he found something in one of the pages that made him think of some part, of some aspect of our government policy, and he launched off onto this tirade against the war. And when he was finished, I said, "Excuse me, Dr. Fink, but that's not true." I forget what he said, something about American policy and tactics and whatnot. "That's not true. How do you know?" "Well, I spent a year there. How much time have you spent there?" And I forget what I said at the time to make my point. After that time, he had a hard time concealing his contempt for me. He just ignored me in class, but he was just fine with me. You know, I contented myself with the thought I could have killed him, but I didn't. And we had several professors like that. My wife had a Shakespeare class. And oddly enough, unbeknownst to us, we did not know how pre-essent Shakespeare was, because it seemed that from her point of view, her professor's point of view, every play Shakespeare wrote had some connection to Vietnam. And of course, we had no idea about this, but according to the professor, it did.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a few demonstrations at San Jose State. I forget when the draft ended, but I know when the draft ended, the college demonstration stopped. That was the morally bankrupt, cowardly part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to get into this. I just had tremendous contempt for them. I would see people on campus and demonstrations displaying the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong flag, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it just made my blood boil. Just, and you couldn't reason with them. You couldn't. Some of them had some intelligent points, but you could not reason with their people. These people, just like you, from my point of view, you can't reason with all the people today opposed to what we're doing, trying to do in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't get it, and nothing has changed. We just have a lot of people in our country, but they, for some reason, don't like our country. And some of them have intelligent, moralistic, humanitarian, religious reasons for their points of view, and that's fine. That's the way our country should work. But when you're basically doing this out of hatred for your own country, and you're trying to give aid and comfort to the enemy, it's going to be a line drawn somewhere. I don't know how you draw the line in our pluralistic culture, but
mm-hmm.
Seeing all these demonstrations the last few weeks, you know, brought back a lot of memories to people like me.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. Like I said, I got over it pretty quick.
And you continued to keep up with the war and go with that.
Yeah, there was a big bridge that the Americans and Vietnamese were trying to build across the Saigon River at Phu Quoc. And I
mm-hmm.
remember seeing the bridge in various travels under different stages of construction. And they finally finished the thing a few weeks, I think, before I left, and I still remember a newspaper one day, some months or a couple of years later, that the North Vietnamese destroyed the bridge, and I knew exactly where that was, and that was kind of a shock that something we tried so hard to build to help the people. Basically, it wasn't necessary from a military point of view. It was just to help the people get across the river.
Mm-hmm.
That the North Vietnamese had blown the bridge up.
Hmm. What did you think of the U.S. Vietnamization policy?
The what?
The Vietnamization policy, turning the war over to the South
Vietnamese.
The hearts
and minds.
Well, actually, the withdrawal of troops and letting the South Vietnamese fight their own war.
This is the
Nixon policy.
Yeah, it was, you know, you declare the war won and you go home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
the peace with honor.
It was stupid, yeah. There was no peace and there was no honor. It's just called quitting. We don't have the will to fight anymore. The American people don't seem to be supporting the war anymore. They're not used to seeing things live on TV every evening at 6 o'clock. And, you know, it was either you won it or you quit. And I guess we just quit.
Mm-hmm.
And we started. That's when the drug use in Vietnam started to escalate in the early 70s, and there was a lot of idleness going on. And when there wasn't much to do anymore, and our part in the war is winding down. But I thought it was, you know, it's just bailing out. It's mm-hmm. turning our backs on the people that we had pledged to help. And I thought it was a very shameful act. Still do.
How did you feel in April 75 when Saigon fell? Do you remember?
Oh, man, I remember that. I remember glued to the television. I remember the helicopter flight off the embassy there. You know, the North Vietnamese tanks rolling down streets that I'd probably been on. You know, it was just shocking. It was by that time, of course, it was just a logical conclusion to our abandonment of Vietnam. But it was shocking to see that happen. You know.
Besides the difficulty sleeping when you heard helicopters, did you suffer from any other kind of PTSD-type incidents?
No, I'm not even sure. Since we first talked, since I did this questionnaire,
mm-hmm.
last year, whenever it was, I've done a little bit more reading about Vietnam. And I'm not even sure PTSD is a valid diagnosis in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
No, I never had that problem. I never had any problems with Agent Orange. And mm-hmm. most people that claim they didn't. None of that. Like I said in my question, I had a little foot fungus, but that mm-hmm. took about a year to go away. Other than that, no big deal.
Mm-hmm. What kind of books have you read about Vietnam?
The most recent book I've read was written by a guy in Dallas, Texas, Stolen Valor.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible book by G.D. Burkett and Glennon Whitley. It's, I've got it right here in my lap. It's just about media representations of Vietnam veterans and their media coverage of the war,
mm-hmm.
and especially the awesome amount of fraud in the VA system, the legions of Vietnam impersonators, all these people that you still see. I mean, if you go to the Vietnam Memorial today, you will see a bunch of ragtag guys in camouflage clothes sitting out with a cup in their hand saying they were Vietnam veterans. See them here in town every once in a while. Just the amount of fraud that goes on.
Why do you think that goes on?
Well, because the Veterans Administration people don't make any effort of any kind to verify if someone who says he's a Vietnam vet is a Vietnam vet. Whether they're claiming PTSD, which is very easy to fake and should get better over the years, according to the psychological manuals, but somehow in the VA system it doesn't. And Agent Orange, you know, people who come in and say, yeah, this orange powder drifted down over me. That's pretty good for a clear liquid. Mm-hmm. Now, there's just not a lot of follow-up, and they make the point that there are thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of imposters drawing veterans' benefits, never were in Vietnam, may not have been in the Army, claiming disability for something that's easy to fake, and they get away with it. And it's all very well documented, and I thought that was pretty shocking to find out about that. And other parts of the book deal with just media stereotypes of Vietnam veterans and whatnot, but I'm sure they have an axe to grind, too, but had some information that I wasn't aware of.
What are the myths of the Vietnam soldier?
Oh, boy. Jeez. Where do you start with this? God. Let's see. The Vietnam War was fought by the poor and by minorities. That's not true. That's not true at all. Hispanic and black deaths, for example, in Vietnam, were actually less than their proportion of draft-age people back home. That's just not true. This class war stuff, the best and the brightest didn't go and all that, that's just not true. 80% of the guys that served in Vietnam were high school graduates. That's far higher than World War II. If you look at the socioeconomics of it, this class warfare crap, MIT, 1992, compared the socioeconomics of 58,000 Americans killed in Vietnam to 58,000 randomly chosen contemporaries back in the States by rating their home of record compared to per capita income. And they discovered that 30% of the soldiers killed in Vietnam were from the lowest third of the income range. But 26% of the combat deaths in Vietnam came from the highest third. And this wouldn't be expected if you bought into the media bias that it was a class war. That's not true. So it was not a class war. The war did not take the highest toll of minorities. We had a very highly educated combat force. The desertion rate was far lower than World War II. This drug use thing. And there was a lot of drug use in the last couple of years of the war. That's when things really escalated. But the use of drugs, like I think I pointed out quite succinctly in my questionnaire, in Vietnam was actually lower in Vietnam by 0.05% than the use of drugs in the Army overall. That's not true. There was a myth that the Vietnam vets came back and couldn't get jobs. The homeless vet, which is still here. I see people on street corners and freeway interchanges here in San Jose, occasionally say Vietnam vet. And, you know, they're 30 years old, you know, and people give them money. It irritates me. But Vietnam veterans are no more likely to be unemployed than men who didn't serve in Vietnam. This is getting to be kind of ancient history now. In fact, have a lower unemployment rate than those that didn't serve. So that's not true. In fact, almost anything that the popular culture thinks about Vietnam veterans is not true. Vietnam soldiers did not shoot up with drugs to dull the horrors of combat. American soldiers did not desert. American soldiers did not have high rates of incarceration when they got home. Most Vietnam veterans are just like me. They came home and they got on with their life. Most Vietnam veterans The Washington Post did a survey. I don't know what year, but they did a survey about Vietnam veterans, and 74% said they enjoyed their time in service. They didn't agree with the statement that the United States took unfair advantage of me. Most Vietnam veterans said they benefited in the long run by going to Vietnam. And 91%, according to what I'm reading here from the survey, 91% who served in Vietnam were glad that they served their country. And the facts, which is easily verifiable, runs completely counter to stereotypes that still prevail to this day. Mm-hmm. Last October, on Halloween at my school, we had the kids can wear costumes to school. And there was a kid that was dressed like a bum, a beggar, one of my former students, who should know better. And he had a sign, Vietnam vet, we'll work for food. Mm. And Devin and I, we had a nice little conversation about that. And, of course, what does he know? He's just a little 12-year-old punk.
But what about his parents?
But I don't know where he gets this, but, this you still see this attitude. Like I think I said in my questionnaire somewhere, I had several parents that removed their students from my class only because they knew I was a Vietnam veteran. No other reason. Never talked to me. Just told the principal that I want my child out of this man's class, you know, because he's probably a dope head, crazed mass murderer, you know, a baby killer. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was so disrespectful. Didn't have the courtesy or the guts, whatever, to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And I still remember one woman did apologize to me. I still remember this. Now, I was teaching fifth grade at Parker School here in San Jose in 76. A woman had her daughter removed from my class. And the reason the principal gave was that I was a Vietnam veteran, and he didn't want to cause any problems. Well, he never talked to me, but I still remember we had some kind of a field day, activity day, toward the end of the year, and this woman and I ended up working in the same booth together, selling Cokes or something, and she did apologize to me. She said, I shouldn't have taken my daughter out of your class. I should have gotten to know you better, but... I was just kind of worried about her being in the same room as a Vietnam vet. But so she did have the courtesy and sensitivity to apologize. But several of the parents simply did not. Mm-hmm. So these things still persist until this day. You go to any veterans event, any big veterans event, and you'll see this little ragtag brigade of people that claim to be Vietnam veterans, who are, of course, not old enough to be Vietnam veterans, hanging around in their camouflage uniforms and their scraggly beards and whatnot, claiming to be the real thing. And they'll be the ones that the reporters flock to, you know, not the guys over there in suits with gray hair and coming up in nice cars and having worthwhile jobs, but the media will still talk to these people. And hardly a week goes by without somebody somewhere in this country being unmasked as an imposter, just a plain liar. Mm-hmm. You probably read about these and heard about these things, too. I have a couple websites I check at frequently. Mm-hmm. One is called Fake Warriors. And hardly a week goes by without somebody in some rather high-profile position or job someplace being unmasked as a liar about his or her Vietnam service. And I don't recall that happening in World War II. I don't think we had any World War II service imposters. Mm-hmm. But we sure had with Vietnam. I found one here in San Jose last Memorial Day. Our local paper profiled three veterans. I guess it was Veterans Day. They profiled three veterans. And anybody with a computer can get online to look at several different databases to see if this person was in Vietnam. And oddly enough, the comments made me think. Two of the men, the paper mentioned they were Vietnam veterans, but in their comments, neither of the men that were in Vietnam talked about their service there. It was just talked about, you know, I'm proud to be an American, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. The one guy who turned out not to have served in the Army at all, let alone Vietnam, was very strident about it. I fought in Vietnam and I risked my life and I saw all kinds of horrible stuff that haunts me to this day, blah, blah, blah. So there's several databases you can look at online. And I put their names into the databases, and sure enough, the two guys that were very reticent about their military service were indeed Vietnam veterans. The other guy's name showed up nowhere. You know, so this still persists.
Did you actually expose them, or did it
No.
come out otherwise?
No, I sent an email to the author of the article. Never heard back.
Mm-hmm.
So just, I didn't say this guy was a total fraud. I said, for some reason, this guy's name does not show up
mm-hmm.
in databases of Vietnam veterans, which are admittedly are sometimes incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one thing that really does make my blood boil. And there have been many high-profile cases. Brian Dennehy, the actor, he's a Vietnam imposter. And there are lots of people that should have known better who have lied about their service. And that's why the name of this book is called Stolen Valor.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the main thrust of the book. So even we somehow can't get past this, this Vietnam stereotype. And even today, 30-something years later, we still have people that are lying about their service and are getting government tax-free government benefits that they don't deserve. And many Vietnam veterans, of course, did get PTSD and did suffer from Agent Orange, but I think even those problems have been blown out of proportion.
You're a middle school math teacher right now, is
yeah.
that correct? Now, you're around these young folks. What do you tell them about Vietnam?
Nothing.
Or what would you tell a younger generation about the Vietnam War?
I tell them to find out on their own. I tell them, I show, almost every year I've shown my slides of Vietnam to the students, especially in sixth grade. And I have an English language development class, which is about half Vietnamese. And I show them my slides, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I just tell them what I'm going to tell you is based on what I experience. It's my point of view. You need to realize other people have different points of view that don't agree with mine. And, as you get older, make up your own mind. American students, at any level, basically never study Vietnam or World War II, for that matter. American high school students and college students are, as far as I can tell, almost completely ignorant about history. They don't have a clue about anything that's happened in this century. And we basically ignored this century. We teach up to the 20th century. We spent a lot of time on the Revolution and whatnot, the Roman Empire, to the detriment of knowing about the 20th century. They're tremendously ignorant about it. So I just tell them, the Vietnamese students know that I was in Vietnam, I speak Vietnamese, and word gets around the school that Mr. Marshall was in Vietnam. And sometimes a kid will ask me, were you in the Army? Yeah. Were you in Vietnam? Yeah. Did you kill anybody? I don't think so. And I don't talk about it unless I'm asked.
Mm-hmm.
We only have two veterans at our school. Both of us are Vietnam veterans. Most kids have never met a veteran. Most kids have never met anybody in the services. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you go to many countries and you'll see soldiers standing around on street corners. But I ask my students, how many of you ever seen a soldier in uniform? Nobody. I mean, it's an alien occupation to them. So I don't talk about it unless somebody asks me, and even I just keep it to very simple.
Mm-hmm.
A German kid asked me about 2 weeks ago. He heard, "Were you in the Army?" Because this is when the Iraq thing came up.
Mm-hmm.
And on my wall, on my window, in my room, I have pictures of every man killed in Iraq, and they're all their names.
Mm-hmm.
I print them off a website every day. I add to it every day, and every kid in the school walks by that
mm-hmm.
every day. And I have a little sign up above with an American flag that says, some gave all. All gave some, but some gave all. And here's the list of all the dead. These are people. They have faces. They're not just a name in the paper. One of them went to the high school that a lot of you are going to. Two of them were born in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm very blatant about how I support the troops. And a couple of kids have asked me, you were in the Army, weren't you? Yeah. Vietnam, yeah. And I usually let it go at that. But when I show my slides to my students, to my ESL students this year, toward the end of the year, nothing else to do, they're just astonished by it. They never heard any of this thing. The Vietnamese kids have heard a lot about the war from their
mm-hmm.
parents and their grandparents who escaped all that horror. And sometimes, in years past, I've had a few Vietnamese students tell the class, what did you do to get here? What did your parents do to get to this country? Jose, your parents took a bus from Tijuana, right? Okay, Maximilian, your parents came up here from El Salvador, right? Now, Chung, how did your parents get here? Harrowing stories.
Mm-hmm.
Treks to Cambodia and Laos and leaving the country and junk ships and being attacked and raped and beaten by Thai pirates and living in refugee camps in Malaysia and Hong Kong. Just horrible stories of heroism. So I like to let the Vietnamese kids, through their parents' and grandparents' eyes, tell their story. I don't have anything relevant to tell the kids, but I just want them to know that a lot of people suffered to enjoy life in America.
You've made it very clear about how you feel about your experience and your service there in Vietnam. Is there anything that you would change about your service?
No.
Or your experiences there?
No. I like I said on my questionnaire, I think it wouldn't be in my power to do any changes. Things worked out about as well as could be expected there. I enjoyed my time there. It was wasn't a life-affirming experience or anything like that, but I wouldn't trade it. You know, if I had to do it again, I'd do it again. I'm proud of my service. I think it made the best of it. I think that my unit had a useful role and justified our existence there. And again, the advisor relationship, the advisor type of service, I think was pretty much unique in U.S. military history. And I'm just proud to have been a part of that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the most significant thing you learned while you were there for that year?
What did I say on my questionnaire? You know, life isn't fair. I think we already knew that. Pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the war's most affected your life?
It's an oddly enough, in an ironic way, it's enabled me to be, since I still speak some Vietnamese, it's enabled me to be a better teacher to my Vietnamese American students. You know, so came around full circle.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the U.S. government and lessons learned from Vietnam. What do you think went on? Do you think that there were lessons learned from Vietnam, or are we still learning them, or did we turn our back on that experience?
Well, I don't know. I'm not that smart. I don't operate in those high circles. I think one of the big improvements in military operations that we've made since then is now the services can plan together and coordinate together and work together instead of being in their own little separate bailiwick. I think we saw the effects of that just in the last few weeks in Iraq, where everybody worked together and supported each other. In Vietnam, it really wasn't that way. The Marines had their thing, and the Navy had its thing, and the Air Force had its thing. There wasn't a lot of coordination sometimes among and between the services. I think that's improved quite a bit. I think the lesson basically learned from Vietnam, as we saw in the last few weeks, is if you're going to get in the war, then get in the war and get it in there with full force and get it over with as soon as possible to minimize the loss of life and destruction. You know, end it quickly. I think we learned that lesson, and we applied it in Iraq in the last month or so.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I'm not sure that we've learned anything. It's interesting to see these Iraqi soldiers and the Fedayeen in Iraq with these RPG-9 self-propelled rocket grenades, exactly identical to the ones used by the communists in Vietnam. And we still, to this day, don't have anything in our arsenal like that. Just as simple, cheap, reliable, low-tech, works like a charm, will burn through a foot of reinforced steel or concrete. And it's just interesting to see those things. I have pictures of myself holding those because one of my jobs was to, you know, as I said before, analyze captured weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are still around. And our military still doesn't have an equivalent weapon. We have, you know, we have bazooka-type things, little wire-guided rocket launchers, but they're real high-tech and don't work half the time. And I just think sooner or later, you know, wars are won by guys on the ground with good weapons, and we have that now. But seeing those rocket launchers just made me think, the bad guys still have those things, and they still kill a lot of ours, and we don't have anything like that to kill them with. We just rely on bombing and heavy artillery and things like that. So, but at least in terms of service coordination, I think we've made a lot of progress. And again, the will to win. If we're going to fight the war, let's go and let's know what we're fighting for right up front.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not screw around for years and be unable to articulate why we're there, like President Johnson did or didn't. You know. So I think in terms of will to win, fight it to the conclusion. Don't quit. In service coordination, we have learned some lessons. And also, this embedding the reporters thing was pretty good. I think that was a good strategy by the Pentagon, because you get reporters right there with the units, unfiltered. There's not a lot of room in there for media skepticism and criticism and backstabbing and Monday morning quarterback type stuff like we had in Vietnam. Because in Vietnam, the reporters just out on their own, basically. And I never saw a reporter in Vietnam. Probably a good thing, too. But still remember, I may have mentioned it before, Morley Safer for CBS said that somebody asked him if you were in Vietnam, he was in Vietnam as a reporter, and if you were with an American patrol and you, for some reason, saw a Viet Cong ambush up ahead, would you warn the men? He said, no. That's not my job as a reporter. You know? So that let me know right away the moral leanings of these guys.
Mm-hmm. So. We talked about books about Vietnam. What about movies on Vietnam?
Never seen one.
Is that by choice?
There have been quite a few movies about Vietnam. Apocalypse Now and Platoon and a few others. I've purposely not watched any. There's two I thought were pretty straightforward. Bat 21, mm-hmm. Gene Hackman, and Flight of the Intruder, about some guys trying to bomb a missile installation in Hanoi, because there's enough cynicism in the movies to make it realistic. But all these other big Hollywood epics, especially anything by Oliver Stone, I know that most of what's there does not reflect reality.
Okay.
At least not my reality, and there's no point getting myself all worked up about it. So I purposely ignored all of that.
Okay. Okay. What do you think about Vietnam today?
I don't know. I think the people are starting to make a few stirrings for freedom. I know that northern Vietnam is a lot more tightly controlled than South Vietnam. I've had quite a few students over the years go back to Vietnam. I've got one there now.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come back, they always ask them about how, because most of them have never been there before. It's their first trip.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of say it, you know, they're kind of a freewheeling, happy-go-lucky place. At least the southern part of Vietnam is, because they were always very entrepreneurial, very commercial and whatnot. Now, the country's got a lot of potential. The government, from time to time, the Politburo, from time to time, does seem to have a few little twitches of opening things up a little bit, but they still arrest Buddhist priests. They still tightly control the population. It's easier to come and go now. Their economy, at least at the higher levels, is still collectivist. But the country's got a lot of potential. I mean, they got to look around them, and they got to see other Southeast Asian countries just making money hand over fist. You know, Korea, Malaysia, Hong Kong. Well, not Hong Kong anymore. Even a little hole in the wall like Brunei Darussalam. They're getting rich. Thailand's pretty prosperous. And here they are with a per capita income of under $300 still, while the rest of Southeast Asia is making a pretty good go of it in the modern world. And I think time will kind of loosen things up. I hope. You know, there aren't many communist societies left.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the dustbin of history will await them also.
Hmm.
I have thought about going back from time to time. I know a few guys that have gone back, but I don't really have any desire to do that yet. Right now.
Why not?
I don't know. There are no happy memories to see. I'm sure the places where I was have been bulldozed or destroyed or become civilian housing by now. And I don't know. I just don't have any desire to do that. Hard to say why. Just don't have any desire.
Have you ever been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington,
yeah,
D.C.?
Yeah, as I mentioned in my questionnaire, I was there in July 8th, 1995.
What was that?
Quite a sobering experience.
Okay.
For all the ragtag brigade hanging around, they're everywhere. All these Vietnam pretenders hanging around.
Were you more keen to checking those guys out? Or
no. They were kind of off in the fringes, hawking T-shirts and bumper stickers and whatnot. But the wall itself, of course, I'd seen many pictures of it, knew what mm-hmm. it looked like. I'd just never seen it in its totality. It's just this big black slash in the ground there, and
mm-hmm.
People making rubbings and flags everywhere and pictures, and it was just a very sobering experience. We lost 40-something guys out of my unit when I was there, but I did not know any of their names, so I was. It's kind of hard to find anybody's name on there since they're chronological.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a very sobering experience to be there. I took off my hat and shed a few tears there. It was really hard to talk to my wife and kids for a few minutes. And they were very respectful, too, because they knew how much it meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
But first, when the thing was built, I said, this is the monument we're going to have. This basically that was kind of an insulting line. But well, when you get there and see the real thing, see the sweep of it, it's a sobering thing, and also I think it's ultimately inspiring to see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, sir, is there anything else that you would like to talk about that we have not covered in our series of conversations?
Can't think of anything. It's
okay.
Pretty comprehensive.
Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and end the oral history interview now with Mr. Fred Marshall. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Appreciate it.